This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to start with a discussion about a common frustration among people with disabilities. It's that other people can't seem to see beyond the disability. An upcoming exhibition, Artists First, aims to challenge perceptions and raise awareness about accessibility at museums as well. Sherry Shirek founded Arts Access for All after losing her sight to diabetes. Her husband, Jesse, with low vision since birth, is an artist. They say most arts organizations they work with are genuinely interested in making accessible spaces, even if they face budget limits. And as we learned in this conversation with our Ashley Thornburg, their work is also about empowering people with disabilities to make their needs known.
They didn't feel comfortable going into some places, not feeling welcome or feeling like they're being treated differently. We had a 12-month training, and each month we focused on a different disability, so then the arts community could learn more specifically about disabilities, just to have some more understanding and compassion.
Some things that pop into my mind, we see ramps at places, and we have seen people who are able to work in sign language and do some work within that community. I wonder if there are some elements that you can talk about that some people, myself included, it wouldn't even occur to us to think about this.
When I lived in Minneapolis, I would go to the Institute of Art. I walked around without a cane, so I didn't have a visible disability unless somebody looked at my eyes. They might be able to tell something was up. So I would get really close to the pieces of artwork to see them, and then I'd have security guards following me around the museum trying to make sure I'm not doing anything inappropriate, but also I felt like they were trying to intimidate me. It was always very hard for me to see the title and the artist who's creating a particular artwork. But now, if I were to go into that same museum, I would request audio description. It helps me fill in the gaps. I might be able to see what's pictured in, say, a Picasso painting, but there are pieces of it that I'm missing. That description helps my brain interpret what's there. It's a much more enriching experience.
I myself have gotten followed around, but for touching the art, and you're not supposed to do that, but I'm kind of a tactile learner. That's wouldn't fall under this purview exactly. Even if you are only looking at it from the perspective of how people learn differently and take in that information, is there some overlap there?
One of the ways of accommodating a person with vision loss might help a tactile learner. There's a couple of ways of doing, say, a touch tour. We had an opportunity to touch a sculpture of Picasso's goat. How many people get to do that? You could certainly have a replica of a sculpture on a smaller scale that could be handled so that it would be touchable. And then there's also three-dimensional pieces of work that can be taken from a two-dimensional image. Also, when you touch it, sometimes audio will play and give you more information about what you're touching.
Wow. Sherry, you have been active in this community for a long time. How do you feel about the trajectory?
Improvements are being made. For instance, the FMCG now has sensory-friendly shows. I know that the Plains does a lot of that. There's a lot more awareness. The Arts Partnership is very much in support of this. Changes are happening. It's being talked about more. It's more out there. And I'm keeping it moving. Make sure we meet regularly, that we always have some sort of project going.
What is the show that you are working on right now?
It's called Artists First. We wanted to give people with disabilities the opportunity to enter their artwork into an art show that was juried, go through the process, understand what it is all about, and feel safe and comfortable. People with disabilities, they don't want to identify as a person with a disability. That isn't the whole person. I want people to take me seriously. I don't want to be coddled. I don't want to be told I'm amazing because I have a disability and I can do things that other people can do. It's kind of hard because it's about expectations. Do people expect people with disabilities to be able to do amazing work? And if you think about famous artists, Monet had blindness, Van Gogh had mental illness.
Let's talk about the work that you are creating for the show.
I'm doing a series of paintings that have lotus flowers floating on the water. The idea is that, you know, they're not going to be necessarily a realistic image of a lotus flower. It's not going to look like a photograph. I would be able to create a painting that would look like a photograph. But the intention is help the viewer understand, why is this an image of a lotus flower? Like, what does this mean? Where's the symbolism? When I create artwork, it's an interesting process because there's a dynamic there with me as a person who's legally blind creating artwork that's primarily visual. So there's always this disconnect of what is the person with perfect vision seeing versus what am I seeing, and how do I relay that message? So as a young person, I wanted to create perfection. I wanted to be able to create artwork that was indistinguishable from a person with perfect eyesight. Mm-hmm. And I was able to accomplish that using magnification. But I came to realize that as I studied art, that art isn't necessarily about having things perfect. Mm-hmm. There was an artist from Minneapolis. His name is Sean Conaty. And he would create these phenomenal works where he would take brush from the environment. And he had these 20 by 20 foot panels. And he'd put oil paint over the top of them, like a dark brown oil paint. And then he'd put the leaves down over the oil paint. Mm-hmm. And he'd take paper and he'd, you know, walk all over these panels. And then when it dried, he'd peel all the leaves off of the picture, kind of the idea of looking at clouds. I mean, I was fascinated by that. I thought abstraction was just ridiculous until that point. But looking at, you know, surrealist works like Dali with the melting clocks, it really got my brain going in terms of how can you carve out an image out of nothing? How can you make something emerge that isn't there? And so I really dove into that and started creating these works that it's like almost an alternate universe or a different planet or something under the sea that doesn't exist. There's dimension to it, but it's for the most part unrecognizable forms. And I found that really interesting because I was the creator. Mm-hmm. I could pull something out of this chaos that nobody else could see until I created it. So there was like a meditation almost that would take place.
That's so beautiful. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Before the interview started, your wife was showing me some of the adaptive technology that she uses in her work. You touched on this a little bit when you talked about how with low vision you were able to do magnification. Mm-hmm. But I wonder about some of the other adaptive technology that might be specific in the art world.
When I was in college, I studied art. I remember showing up to my first drawing class. And when I was in high school and doing art classes, we would sort of copy from photographs. Mm-hmm. But on the college level, you don't do that. The instructor will put up like a series of like wine bottles on different platforms and you have to draw those or you have to paint those. And so I had this dilemma. I'm sitting 20 feet away from those wine bottles and they look like a blur to me. Or there's a person, you know, standing there in a figure drawing class and I see a blur. So how do I recreate this? One of the things that I would do is I would use, it's called a telescope, and it essentially is like binoculars, but there's one instead of two. And so the telescope that I use is a 10 powered telescope, and it lets you zoom in on the subject. Mm-hmm. And you can focus it and make it crystal clear. But then the dilemma is I'm only seeing one piece at a time. Mm-hmm. So it was like, how do I tie these pieces together? Mm-hmm. And I found techniques. So I would go back and forth between, you know, drawing what I could see of the blurred object with my normal eyesight and then using the telescope to zoom in and see the details and the gradation and shadows and color. And so it was a matter of putting those pieces together. So that was my primary tool for assistive technology. The other piece that I used a lot was a handheld magnifier. So if I was doing a sketch, you know, with a sketch, you want to keep the lines really faint, you know, because you don't want the lines to show. But, you know, with my vision, I have a hard time seeing thin lines. It's like making a map. You know, you make the sketch, it's a map. But then when it comes time to fill in the sketch, I'd use a magnifier to find those visual landmarks on the paper.
Sherry, you are fully blind. Mm-hmm. How do you experience your husband's work?
Through touch. He made me a amazing painting for my birthday, and he made it tactile. I remember color because I haven't always been blind, so having the colors described and that I can see it in my mind's eye. I listen to what he tells me about the experience of creating the art. The first piece of art he made for me, I just cried. I couldn't believe.
The piece itself is an interpretation of the painting of Starry Nights by Van Gogh. You don't see much of the landscape, so the horizon line is really low in the picture. And off to the right is a maple tree with like orange colors, but there's also greens and other spotted colors in there. And off to the left is the full moon. And I added texture to the moon so that it's dotted and there's almost a swirling pattern to the moon. The sky is like this sea of swirling colors, greens and oranges and blues coming at you. They're almost dancing in the sky. So I took this idea, this chaos that Van Gogh had worked on, and tried to interpret it as love rather than chaos. The reason I interpreted the Van Gogh painting is because when we were in New York, we went to MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. We had an audio described tour, and the one painting that I really wanted to see there was Starry Nights. This might sound crazy, but I could feel energy in the space in front of this painting. I've never felt anything like this before, but it was like a vibration. It was a vibration throughout my entire body. And after I felt this vibration as she was talking, all of a sudden I felt this wave of sorrow wash from my head to my feet. Sherry said to me, "Did you feel that?"
I can feel an energy from it. When it was hanging on the wall in the living room, I could just feel it when I walked in the room, like in my body, in the room. It was a sense of love and warmth. And I would always kind of go up and touch it. But just knowing it's there and it was in my mind, it's like a body sensation. But that Van Gogh, that was... What was that?
That sounds better than looking at it, frankly.
Yes, it was.
When did you lose your vision?
I was 23. I was in college. And it was caused from diabetes.
Oh.
Yep. I was sent immediately to rehabilitation to learn how to get my life back. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have time to think, I'm blind, what am I going to do? I didn't have time to go through that depression. Yeah, I mean, I've been blind for more years than I've been sighted. I got a pancreas transplant, and it cured my diabetes.
Oh, wow.
And I just had the anniversary, the 18 years of my kidney transplant. So I have two transplanted organs in my body that are functioning really well. I haven't been on insulin for, it'll be 18 years in March.
If there were a surgery to restore the vision, would you do it?
You know, at this point, I think it would be very strange. Yes, I would. But I think there would be a lot of adapting. Because I'm so used to the way I live now. It's just natural. And especially with the computer. My gosh, I would have to learn it visually. I think that would be really challenging. Because because everything is like through listening, and the way I navigate is very different.
You get sucked in those vortex of those visuals of cat videos, and then there's your whole Saturday. What is your story? Have you had this vision condition since birth?
I was born with cataracts. It wasn't detected until I was about 3 months old. My eyes started losing muscle control. And, of course, my parents just freaked out. They took me to an eye doctor, and they did a number of surgeries. The result was that I had no vision in my right eye, reduced vision in my left eye because they took the lens out. After they took the lens out, my iris wouldn't dilate. My whole eye was like blue. It wouldn't open up. My iris. So they had to cut the muscle of the iris to make it open up. But then my eyes were fully dilated all the time. You know, think about going to the eye doctor and your eyes are dilated.
Yeah.
As a teenager, I started to develop glaucoma, which is like the pressure inside of your eye. And essentially with glaucoma, your eye has a certain eye pressure. Normal is like 20. Mine started creeping up towards 30. And then all of a sudden I had a retinal detachment. So the back of my eye, the retina, detached partially, and I started seeing these psychedelic colors. Had that repaired, but I lost a lot of vision in the lower half of my eye. I had a hard time in school. You know, when I was young, they didn't really realize that I couldn't see very well until I was in second grade. I think it was just like, oh, he doesn't see very well. We can't really fix it. But I think I was smart enough where I could adapt to most things. I was a good listener. I could adapt to most things except for math. And I was having a really hard time with reading. Then my parents took me to the School for the Blind in Grand Forks, which at the time was a residential school. Mm-hmm. They were able to, you know, teach me how to multiply and do math. And in some ways, it was a really good experience because it helped me catch up and go back to the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one thing is I started learning Braille. And the one thing about Braille is that people don't really think it's, if you can see something, they don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. In our culture, eyesight is the predominant sense.
Mm-hmm.
So they started teaching me Braille, and I was doing pretty well with it, but I was reversing a lot of the letters. And so they thought, oh, let's just teach him how to read print with magnification.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of it was that I never, as a child, learned how to read print. You know, I tried and I struggled and they just kind of gave up on it. You know, so I was labeled as like learning disabled and I couldn't spell. And I went back into the public school systems and I did well in school. Like, I mean, I think I didn't do excellent, but I graduated with like a 3.0. So, you know, I think I slid by, but then it was time for college and I struggled initially. You know, I went to UND and I just had a lot more fun hanging out with people than I did in class. They didn't welcome me back the following year. So I went to school in Wahpeton and started studying computers. And I'd always had a love for like technology and figuring things out. I think what taught me how to read was the internet. In 1997, you know, there were a lot of web pages and I was interested in what was out there. So I would just slowly read. I think I became a better reader. You know, it was slow, but I was able to do it. I was able to teach myself how to read. Graduated from that program and went on to college at the U of M in Minneapolis, which is ironically a writing intensive university. So there's a lot of writing. And it's interesting because I've gotten to the point where I love to write now. I mean, I do a lot of writing. To circle this all back, I think people are so afraid of vision loss.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand that because most of the things we do are visual.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how many things some professionals do non-visually. Like think about going to the doctor. How much of when they examine you is actually using their eyes?
Mm-hmm.
They're taking your pulse. They're feeling your abdomen. They're listening to your heart. Those are all non-visual skills.
Mm-hmm.
There is a way to do everything non-visually. We haven't figured out how to drive yet. We're working on that.
Well, autonomous vehicles are right on the way. So
technology needs to hurry up.
I can't wait.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you for listening to us. Love to help the public understand that there's a lot more out there than you think.
Life isn't over. You can live a fulfilling, happy life and live the life you want.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talking with Sherry and Jesse Shirick, co-organizers of Artist First, an exhibition featuring work from artists with disabilities. And there's still time to apply. The submission deadline is Monday. You can find out more at artsafa.org. That's artsafa.org.